Good morning, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this very snowy, at least in Milwaukee, Tuesday morning, the 17th of January. This hour, Congress has returned from its winter break, and lo and behold, they're dealing with the same issues they dealt with before they went on their winter break. The fight over extending a payroll tax cut and long-term unemployment benefits, that fight will pick up again as Congress returns to work today. And of course, we've got a presidential campaign going on with President Obama saying that he plans to run against a do-nothing Congress. Will indeed it be a do-nothing Congress? And why is that the case when the American people would like action on more than a few issues? We have as our guest today staff writer for Roll Call, John Stanton. We'll be welcoming phone calls for John as we always do. Our phone lines are open right now, of course, and the number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. Hi, John.
How are you?
I'm okay. How are you?
I'm pretty good. It's unfortunately not snowing here. We're just getting some nasty rain. So.
Oh, you are? Well, it's weird. It has been the weird. I hate to start with the weather, except we're thinking about it right now. We've had absolutely no snow until last week. It's January, and now it's coming in. So, you know, it's slippery, but we had a month and a half with no snow.
That's crazy. I can't believe that y'all had no snow at all. Here, it's pretty unpredictable all winter long, so I'm not totally surprised.
Yeah. Where are you from, y'all, you said?
From D.C. I'm a
born
and raised here. Yes, indeed. I am one of the few natives that actually worked in politics. It was crazy enough to get involved in this after watching it up close my entire life.
Well, you got a whole long history then of knowing what's going on, sir.
That's exactly why most everyone stays out of it, I think.
So Congress is back, and the strange thing is they're dealing with exactly the same thing they dealt with in a rather contentious fashion when they left.
Yeah, this is sort of the story of this Congress, really. You know, we saw this, with the spending last year. We're going to see some of the similar kind of fights, I think, again this year. Obviously, the first one up that is a repeat is this payroll tax cut, unemployment insurance extension, where, you know, I think Republicans are hoping to really try to regroup over the next 10 days. You know, they left town beaten up pretty badly because of sort of the missteps that Speaker Boehner had in handling his negotiations with Harry Reid and Mitch McConnell in the Senate. There are still some raw feelings, I think, between Republicans in the House and Senate, frankly, because the Senate Republicans feel like they were trying to act like adults and get something done, and House Republicans undermine them. And so it's not quite a restart, but I think Republicans are hoping that it's going to be a restart, whereas Democrats are clearly feeling like, for the first time since the last election, at least, that they have some sort of momentum and upper hand against Republicans.
Mm-hmm. And the Republicans are going on some kind of retreat in Baltimore this week?
They are indeed. This is their annual sort of get together where it's a closed door meeting by and large. They sometimes will bring members out to talk to us, but we basically go sit in a room in a hotel in Baltimore while they sit in a much larger room and talk about what they're going to do for the year, what some of their strategies are. This year, I believe Chris Christie is going to be coming, the governor of New Jersey,
mm-hmm.
who is very popular amongst rank-and-file Republicans and conservative Republicans. Sort of a, you know, he's an interesting character in that he gets to both sides of the party to a large degree. He's going to be coming to address them and sort of talk about stuff. I think it's more of a pep rally for him and for them than anything else. So,
and tell me about the dissent in the Republican Party. Is Speaker John Boehner, has he worked that all out, or does he have a lot of people who are still upset with him?
I think you know, he definitely has a problem there. You know, we wrote about this sort of before the big blow up over the payroll thing, and this problem that he has goes back to the beginning of last year, where, you know, some of it is the freshmen, but by and large, most of it are actually older Republicans that have been around for a while that have been looking for a chance to try to push this very conservative agenda, particularly a lot of the social issues, but also on the fiscal side. And, you know, he is not, I think, his efforts to try to find a way to have a grand bargain with the Obama administration on something, trying to fix a lot of these problems so that Republicans didn't have to constantly have a fight over spending cuts but could try to address some other things, really rubbed those people the wrong way. They felt like they should just focus on those things and that, you know, sort of the the public be damned and public opinion be damned. We're going to do this. We're going to do what we've been talking about doing for 30 years. And, you know, the payroll tax fight was really where that blew up. And I think he's going to continue to have that problem throughout the year. It'll probably start to get a little bit worse as they get closer to the election. And some of these members start to feel like they need to distance themselves much more publicly from leadership to show that they are still these Tea Party types and that they are still, you know, the independent operator that came to Washington to change it, as opposed to becoming part of the system itself. So,
and what's the story, John, with the payroll tax? Is it going to expire in 2 months now? What, at the end of February or what?
Yeah, basically what it looks like is going to happen is I doubt that they will get that far. There has already been some negotiations on the staff level, on the conference committee between the House and Senate on sort of where to move, where to go on this thing. I don't think Republicans are going to want to see this thing get up to the deadline again. They would like to pass at least one bill without the threat of a government shutdown or the shutdown of some popular program or some level of Armageddon, which is what they've been facing all year. So I suspect that they will maybe get this done, you know, the first week of February. So they'll get it done hopefully within 10 days of its expiration.
And what about unemployment benefits?
That will be part of the same deal. They are linked to the point that they cannot be undone. So if they get one done, they'll get both done.
Raising the debt ceiling.
That will also get done. We've already started to see some interesting rhetoric, you know, that you know, the fact that they're raising the debt ceiling is an indictment of the Obama administration is a press release that went out from the Speaker's office. You know, this was sort of expected. It was part of the deal that they signed in July. They knew they were going to have to raise the debt ceiling again now, no matter what happened. There was no way they could have done enough cutting to the federal budget to not have to raise it. So the next couple of days and probably the next week, you'll see a lot of hyperventilating over this. But the fact is that the procedure they put in place for this to be done, it's impossible for Republicans to stop it. So it will get raised.
Here's an article, and several articles repeat this same thing. Democrats who run the Senate and Republicans who control the House acknowledge that outside of the payroll tax cut bill, no major legislation is expected to make it through Congress this year. Do you agree?
I do. I think, you know, in the past, election years were always sort of a tricky time for major pieces of legislation. You saw the Clean Air Act amendments in the 90s were passed during an election season. I believe EPA was created during the 72 election. So, you know, there is this history of big things, big ideas getting done during an election, especially if there's some kind of public pressure. That said, this Congress is not constituted for such a bipartisan sort of deal making that would have to go on to do that. And I think that at best we're going to see them maintain government operations at the level that they're at. Maybe cut, you know, maybe see some more cuts in the appropriations bills for next year. But other than that, you know, they're going to talk a good game about trying to do a transportation bill. I think Speaker Boehner, in particular, would like to do that while he still has a strong majority in the House, and he has the White House and Senate Democrats in sort of a bind, and because he wants to try to reform the way that they do transportation, so that it's less about earmarks and just sort of sending government money out, but more about results, I guess is how they would describe it.
Well, if nothing happens, then what does everybody campaign on?
On how much they hate each other?
Oh, great.
Yeah. Unfortunately, I think that's exactly what we're going to be seeing. You know, I think Democrats are already starting. The White House is going to be campaigning largely against Congress and using Congress as its example of why, you know, whoever the eventual nominee is will be a bad person to elect. You're going to see similar kind of a thing going on with Democrats. They're going to try to stoke as much as they can the idea within particularly the Tea Party that these guys have failed you, so that they can either get them primaried or suppress Republican turnout so they can try to get their guys back into office. And then you're going to see Republicans basically running on the platform of, we did everything we could to stop the horrible Obama administration and horrible Democratic ideas they were trying to push, and this is why we got nothing done. So mm-hmm. it's going to be pretty ugly, I would imagine.
Mm-hmm. Tell me about this Keystone matter. The administration is facing a congressionally mandated deadline, February 21st, I believe, to approve the project or to explain why it won't work.
Right. you know, this was part of the original sort of debt deal that they came up with, or payroll tax deal. And, you know, the administration is under a lot of pressure on both sides on this pipeline. It would create a lot of jobs. It would help with some there's some thought that would help with reducing energy prices because you're bringing energy down from Canada. But, you know, environmentalists are very, very opposed to the idea of this pipeline. There are concerns, you know, within individual local communities that are concerned about having the pipeline run through their community and the safety of it. And, you know, this is not like Alaska where it's the middle of nowhere and it's one state and one federal government. You've got multiple states who would be involved. A lot of these areas have significant populations in them. So, you know, there is a concern there, I think. And, you know, the deal that they cut, though, it was a sort of a way for Republicans to say they got something on it while giving the administration the leeway to make its own decision, which obviously I think we can pretty clearly say is going to be they're going to say no and give some of these sort of safety and environmental concerns as to why.
Mm-hmm. The recess appointments that the president has made, will those be smooth sailing from now on? Consumer affairs, some of the economic appointments?
Well, no. I think, you know, particularly at the Consumer Affairs Department, that is going to be ugly. Republicans, there's been some talk that Republicans were going to hopefully use the first decision that they make as a way to say that they were illegally constituted. The problem is that if you read the Constitution, it's very clear that the White House technically had the right to do what they did, I think. You know, there is a question about tradition, and there is a question about sort of a good faith, you know, expectation that they would follow hundreds of years of tradition in terms of how they define a recess, but they didn't have to legally honor those agreements, and they didn't. That said, I think it's going to make the confirmation process, which has already been fundamentally broken for several years and has just gotten worse and worse during this administration, it's going to make it impossible to get anybody through. I don't think you're going to see almost anybody get confirmed other than very, very low-level types of positions for the rest of the year.
John, how do you explain this incredible historic gridlock? It's not good for the country, and I'm sure in their heart of hearts, most people in Congress would have to say it's not good for them for being able to do any kind of job.
Well, see, that's actually an interesting point you make. I think, you know, we have a tendency to romanticize the past in this country, particularly, but everybody does. And we tend to romanticize our ideas of how Congress worked. And it's always been very, very partisan here. There's always been a certain level of gridlock, and that was sort of the point of how they created the system when the Founding Fathers did it, was to create some gridlock so that rash decisions didn't get made. That said, I think that the last 4 or 5 years in particular have gotten worse, and I think most of it, frankly, you can chalk up to two things. One is this sort of general dissatisfaction with the process, with the two-party system, and with how things are working. Neither party seems to be really appealing to its base and to independent voters the way that they used to. And also, as part of that, the fact that politicians now find themselves basically running for re-election the second they get done getting elected for something. And, you know, that creates enormous pressures to not do anything. People are no longer willing to take hard votes on things because they know that it's going to get thrown back in their face. Even in the Senate, where, you know, it used to say, well, I could take early in my tenure, I could take a hard vote on something because in 6 years no one's going to remember. Well, the internet never forgets. And, you know, campaigns now never forget. And they run, you know, these ugly ads on each other and they tear each other up. And, you know, it's created this sort of vicious cycle of people that are the only ones that are willing to get involved half the time anymore, or people that are willing to essentially be running for re-election nonstop their entire career.
Yeah. We welcome phone calls. John Stanton is our guest this hour, staff writer for Roll Call. Congress is back in session, and they are dealing with some of the very same issues that they dealt with or tried to deal with before they went on their winter break. Here's our phone number for you to join the conversation, 800-486-8655. How does it sit with you to think that Congress is just not going to be able to do much of anything in this election year? Are there issues that you would like for them to address? What would those be? 800-486-8655. 8655 is our number. Our email address is talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. This is a big week in Wisconsin politics as well. Tomorrow at 9, Mike Tate, who is chair of the Wisconsin Democratic Party, is on for the hour to talk about the recall. The signatures will be delivered today. All indications are there are more than enough signatures, which would force a recall. And he'll be here to talk about the Democratic vision for Wisconsin. We do have a call out to the Wisconsin Republican Party for Thursday. We have no word yet from them. We hope they will agree to an hour so we can speak with them on Thursday. To you in a moment, this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And we'll go to your phone calls. Let's start with Nell in Brookfield. Hi, Nell.
Hi. Well, I was calling about the pipeline. I do want to just throw out this idea listening to the discussion about discourse in the government, too. I think there's also a general breakdown of ability to give and take in just public and private discourse anymore for whatever reason. And so we end up being very, you know, talk to the hand sort mm-hmm. of in everything. And, you know, that started a few years ago. But to the pipeline, there are some of us, because of experience in our lives, have opposed that pipeline for another reason. And for me, it's this direct drug line straight into the Midwest, which is a great distribution center for the entire country for drugs. I mean, Kansas City has already become a hub for heroin in this country. I mean, we don't think of the heartland that way, but it's true. And since we are waging a losing battle on drugs in this country, to invite that kind of straight main line, just right into the veins of this country by that pipeline is appalling to me and terrifying. And it's just one of these, you know, these unintended maybe consequences, but it's very dangerous.
John.
Yes.
Do you want to respond?
Well, you know, it's funny. I think I don't know much about the drugs and the pipeline. Although I can see sort of how, especially with the construction, you could definitely have a situation like that. You know, on the caller's point, though, on the breakdown of the ability of people to give and take, I do think that there is a lot of that you see in Washington, and it is a broader social phenomena. It becomes, I think, though, very much more escalated here in Washington because of the, you know, what's at stake. This is no longer simply a discussion between two neighbors about, say, you know, religious beliefs or something. This is, you know, a discussion over where our country's going to go, where billions of dollars are going to be spent. And as such, I think it gets uglier and uglier. And the sad part, though, is that we, as a people, tend to immediately tell each other we don't like this. And yet, we end up supporting the people that do it the most at the end of the day. So I don't know sort of what to do about that, frankly, but I do think it's a disturbing sort of trend.
And the president's going to have difficulty with this issue as well, because my understanding is that there was very effective lobbying done by environmental groups that persuaded the president to take a certain stand on this. For him to change his mind would be very upsetting to a core base of his, and it's an election year.
That's right. And, you know, this administration, unlike the Clinton administration, which sort of made a calculation, which it turned out to be right for them, frankly, which was that, you know, the base groups like environmentalists were not going to leave home, and that they were going to vote for the men no matter what and come out in large numbers. And so they were willing to break these agreements that they had and these covenants that they had with some of these interest groups, gay rights groups, others, that this administration so far has been reluctant to do. And when they find themselves under pressure, they try to get back to it. There's been some very big, notable exceptions, obviously Guantanamo Bay being probably the most glaring example where they've broken a promise they made to their base. But by and large, they have been trying to find a way to thread the needle where they keep their base happy. And I think you're going to continue to see that at least over the next few months.
Right. Paul in La Crosse. Hi, Paul.
Yes, your guest said that John Boehner wanted to do something in the House of Representatives while he still had some strength. John Boehner, in my opinion, the weakest speaker in the history of the country. I would point that in this last year alone, that he's been the speaker, that twice there have been agreements reached with the Democrats on how to pass legislation. twice, John Boehner has failed because he couldn't keep his caucus in line. And on the Senate side, you can find 55 senators that will vote for things as a majority, but John McConnell requires a supermajority on everything, including appointments. Why is this the Democrats' fault? And where is John Boehner's strength?
Well, you know, I think that the caller raises a couple of good points. You know, there has been this question of whether or not Boehner is either able to maneuver his members into line, or even just sort of the more fundamental question of is he able to accurately gauge where they are when he goes in to have a negotiation with Democrats. And I think on both cases there is legitimate questions to be asked. On the Senate side, the 60-vote majority has been something that since he found himself in the minority, Mitch McConnell has sort of required to be a formal deal for every single vote, which it was increasingly happening that way before he did this, but he sort of basically said, look, everything is going to have 60 votes. And Democrats understand that it has to have 60 votes. And while, you know, Republicans are able to block things, the Democrats in the Senate have not been particularly willing on a lot of issues to try to find common ground with Republicans, and Republicans have not been particularly willing to try to find common ground with them. I think it's less of a Republican or Democratic problem as it is a more systemic breakdown.
Anything else, Paul?
Well, yeah, of course. That's crazy. Olympia Snow is up for election this year, and she was told that if she didn't toe the line, they'd bring in someone more conservative. They have done this with everybody who is so-called moderate bloc of the Republican Party, saying, we have got this nasty thing, and we are going to finance Tea Partiers. They're going to run against you in primaries. Our people show up. Your people don't. You're going to lose. You're going to, you know. She has put her career ahead of her constituents, and that has happened across the board, which is why you can't get Republicans to vote. But there's 55% in my book is a majority, and you should be able to get things passed. You shouldn't need a supermajority to pass everything, including people for the appellate court. No, it's the Republicans.
Thank you, Paul, very much for the call. John, do you want to give us an assessment of the strength of the Tea Party?
You know, I think they found themselves increasingly weak. I think, you know, there was this obvious sort of surge, and you know, I think any social movements, particularly in the United States, they don't last very long, and they start to peter out, you know, after a year or two. At this point, and that's what we've seen with the Tea Party. But I think it's also been exacerbated, frankly, by the fact that Republicans have not done what I think Tea Party activists were hoping they were going to do. There was this expectation amongst them, and I think it was fairly unrealistic in a lot of ways, but it was the expectation nonetheless, that Republicans were going to come into power and they were going to eliminate departments, and they were going to roll back President Obama's health care reform law, and they were going to be able to do all these things, and they haven't been able to do almost any of them at all. They've done a massive amount of cutting of spending, and they've sort of fundamentally changed the way the culture of Washington thinks about spending. But that is not that big of a deal in terms of the larger desires and demands of the party, and I think that has led to a lot of disaffectedness amongst Tea Partiers, frankly, which is reduce their power.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Paul, for the call. Pat in Mequon, hi.
Hi. My theory on this whole thing, I've been thinking about it really for a long time, for years, is that we absolutely need campaign finance reform. But there's no way to get these people, Democrats or Republicans, to vote for campaign finance reform. So the only way I can think of to do that is to start some kind of a movement where everyone insists, everyone who wants to have their government back, insists that their vote means that the person who is running must vote for campaign finance reform.
John.
Well, you know, campaign finance reform is a tricky issue because, you know, what do we mean by that is where the question starts to become. And, you know, both parties will claim that they are for some kind of campaign finance reform. And, you know, most Americans, I think, look at that and they see that as taking corporate money out of the process, more about reducing the, you know, influence of the wealthy, let's say, on elections and of special interests like unions, that kind of thing. Reducing those people so that it's more just the voters who have a say as opposed to, you know, special interest groups. The problem is that, you know, the Supreme Court has ruled that spending money is a part of free speech, and that Congress cannot limit that use of money by entities to influence elections, and frankly, politicians are pretty loath to do so because they get a lot of money for their PACs and for their reelection campaigns from very moneyed interests, and they need them. And so long as the system is not set up where you're in, say, a public funded election system where everybody gets the same amount of money and it's all publicly funded, you're probably going to have this sort of rampant problem that folks like the caller, you know, find distasteful. And you know, there's not an easy solution to it, I think, at this point.
Thank you, Pat, very much for your call. Our number, we have a couple lines open now, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. And our guest is John Stanton, staff writer for Roll Call. He's been a reporter in Washington for a number of years and has been with Roll Call since 2005. Before that, he was with the National Journal. We're talking about Congress returning to session and what we might expect for them. The expectations are pretty low that much of anything will get done during this election year. And what do you think about that? What would you like for Congress to be able to accomplish? 800-486-8655. Appleton, caller Mark. Hi, Mark.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I would agree with your caller. I believe it was Paul talking about the obstruction of Republicans in the Senate. The use of filibuster is at historic levels. I mean, it really is for everything, even though if you look in the Constitution, supermajorities are really limited to certain things. So, and it seems to me that this is a pattern from 2008, that as soon as Obama was elected, Republicans tried to delegitimize his election by saying he wasn't really American, he wasn't born in America. I mean, the whole birther thing, that John Boehner was, or Norm McConnell were ever willing to disavow. You saw Romney's comment to Huntsman about criticizing Huntsman for taking the ambassadorship to China, that he somehow wasn't working to fight Obama from the beginning. You saw it in the health care debate, which took over a year, and yet Republicans complained that it was rammed through Congress. I mean, it took a year to pass. Somehow, though, on a state level, 48 hours was enough time to eliminate collective bargaining in Wisconsin. So it just seems to me that there is this pattern from 2008 that they were not willing to get anything done. And part of that, I would suggest too, is the problem is the gerrymandering that we do, that districts are so either completely Democrat or Republican that the congressmen and senators have, especially congressmen, have no need to compromise because their districts are so because of the gerrymandering that's done. So those are my comments.
Thank you, Mark. John,
you know, I think the question of districts and how they're drawn, I think, it's a very, very good point. You know, the caller is exactly right, frankly, that the way that we have set it up is that members of the House have, except for in very sort of random examples, have no reason to do anything but be very conservative or very progressive. There is no incentive for them to try to find a middle ground where they could represent both Republicans and Democrats. Generally speaking, what happens is a state legislature will redistrict a Democrat or a Republican into a district that forces them to either become a conservative blue dog Democrat or what they call the Main Street Republicans, which is sort of the progressive version of a Republican. There's very few of those right now, but you know there is no sort of, okay, well, it's half Republican or half and half Democrat or something like that. And that creates this very much entrenched political system. On the question of obstruction, Republicans have definitely, without a doubt, done an extraordinary amount of blockading of legislation and of appointments and things like that in Congress. But, you know, I do think that it, to a certain degree, it takes two to tango, right? And Democrats, once it became clear that Republicans were willing to do this, Democrats have not done much to try to convince them to do otherwise. You know, people like Olympia Snow and some of the moderate Republicans in the past have been able to be convinced to come over and break sides with their Republican counterparts. But a combination of the pressure from Republicans and a lack of outreach from Democrats has led even those members to become very, very entrenched and to stay at home on almost everything at this point.
An email that's come in from Robert at Carroll University. Could you comment on the fact that Truman's 1948 do-nothing Congress complaint happened when Republicans controlled both the House and Senate, and that's not the case in 2012? Does that affect what appears to be Obama's upcoming political strategy?
You know, if people were watching and were more, frankly, aware of how things work in Washington and understood how it worked here, I do think that would hurt his strategy, because people would understand that Democrats control, you know, 2/3 of the government and they control half of Congress. But Democrats have done an excellent job of sort of making Congress synonymous with Republicans. And as such, he's going to run against Congress. And he's going to make the case that it's Congress's fault that things aren't getting done, that Congress has been obstructing him. And that, you know, he's in this, like, locked in this battle of wills with John Boehner and Eric Cantor and Mitch McConnell. And he's going to conveniently leave out the fact that Harry Reid does run the Senate, technically. That is what we're going to see. Now, I think that for Senate Democrats in particular, that is a bit of a problematic strategy for them, because they want to be able to try to run on some kind of accomplishments. And that kind of a strategy, you know, precludes any effort to do anything. So I think it's a bigger problem for Senate Democrats and House Democrats than it is for the White House.
There are supposed to be bills introduced early this year by Republicans expanding domestic energy production and also upgrading transportation infrastructure. I don't know if those are wrapped into the same bill. Mm-hmm. Offshore drilling, energy exploration, the Arctic National Wildlife, and giving money to states to build more roads and bridges. Are those all lumped together? It seems like they're two very different things, and there would be a lot more disagreement when it comes to Democratic response to the former if they were wrapped together.
Well, Speaker Boehner would like, I think, if he had his druthers, this would be his big policy bill that he would do. And the reason he wants to do this is because by linking energy and transportation, essentially saying, you know, we will have money for roads and bridges so long as we have increased energy production, and, you know, there is money coming from that that we then use to fund, in some instances, some of this transportation stuff. By linking the two, he essentially cuts out environmentalists out of the energy debate almost entirely, because states and unions will say, give them what they want so we can get the transportation money. And he also, it creates a way for him to take it off budget to a certain degree, in the sense that what happens with transportation, which is essentially, it's an earmark-driven process. It's almost impossible to do a transportation spending bill that is not using earmarks, because lawmakers don't want to just hand over total control to the Department of Transportation and to state regulators. They want to have a say in sort of which projects are going to get some money and which ones aren't, or which ones are priority and which ones aren't. And so taking it off budget like that, so that it has a sort of independent revenue stream that helps pay for it, makes it so that you don't necessarily get called earmarks, and you can sort of say this is a separate thing that we're doing, this is not the federal budget. Now, all that said, I don't think that there's any chance that this is going to pass through the Senate. There's no chance the Senate will take up mm-hmm. his bill at all. Just none. So,
thanks, Mark, for the call. Mike in Wauwatosa, hi.
Yeah, and, you know, it's a good segue to the comment I wanted to make, is, you know, I think talking about the energy situation or lack of an energy policy by this president or any recent previous president is a good indicator of what's happening or what's wrong with Congress in general and Washington in general, is the short-mindedness of the politicians when they deal with things like energy policy. Energy policy should be dealt with on a multiple decade basis. The infrastructure is just much too big. The environmental concerns are much too big. We shouldn't be making decisions based on the economy this year or next year. They really should be based on the fact that once you build a pipeline, you're building an infrastructure which is going to be very difficult to change for the next decade or series of decades. Take, for example, the Keystone Project. Certainly, you know, the argument could be made, well, we're going to pump the oil from Canada all the way across the country, down into the Louisiana, southeast Texas region, because that's where the rest of the pipelines are. The only problem is that then you're just propagating or keeping going the idea that all the energy has to come out of that part of the country. We should be thinking, a rational decision would be looking at, should we really be pumping everything down there into a hurricane zone so that every time we have a major hurricane, we interrupt pipeline operations for the rest of the country? Or should we be distributing that over the rest of the country? And that's the kind of thinking that we should be doing as a nation when we talk about our energy policy or transportation policies or, you know, name the big issue of the day. We need to be thinking about it as a nation, at least the administration should be, because they're representing the entire country. And that's where it's what's wrong here, is that we shouldn't be doing the kind of thing that Boehner wants to be doing. We should not be setting it up so that local politicians have an ability to put their finger into it, because all they're going to do is muck up the works.
John?
You know, I think it's a funny thing, you know, I think the caller hits it right on the head. You know, people in Washington should be looking to long-term, and frankly, Washington has not looked to the long-term in, you know, decades. It's you know, no one wants to take, because those decisions are very difficult for them. No one wants to do it. You know, you're going to have to sacrifice some things which in the short term are going to be painful. You're going to have to make decisions that are not going to be popular with a lot of people in the short term, even though in the long term they may be beneficial. And, you know, politicians really are just unwilling to do that anymore. And, yeah, I mean, that long view is what everyone wants, but no one is really willing to do it to pay the price for it.
Well, and you have to take the long term on many of the issues of the day, right? I mean, you just have to.
Well, but the thing is that Congress has found ways to not actually do that. You know, they do with the way they write budgets or the way they write, you know, spending bills. You know, they build into them these sort of like presumed 10-year timelines or 20-year timelines, but with the understanding that is never actually going to last, that they are going to turn around and undo that in 4 years or 5 years, and that there's no way they're actually ever going to end up doing it. They're just doing it. They make it look as if they're doing it, but in reality, you know, they're never going to actually get there.
Congress has returned from its winter break. What can we expect from Congress during this election year is what we're talking about this hour. John Stanton, staff writer for Roll Call, is our guest. Our phone number, thank you, Mike, for your call. Good calls this morning. Well, they're always good calls, but you're really involved today. It's good. Somebody may be doing nothing, but we're not doing nothing. 800-486-8655 is the number. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. We talk about water the second hour of our program today with Charles Fishman, author of The Big Thirst, The Secret Life and Turbulent Future of Water. He has a lot to say about the countries that are running out of water, the states in the United States that are having water shortages, bottled water, and the water that comes out of your tap. I find this absolutely extraordinary. That's billions of years old. Isn't that something to think about, that? Billions of years old. All right. So that's coming up, hour number two. To you again in a moment. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Tomorrow at 9, Mike Tate, chair of the Wisconsin Democratic Party, will be with us to talk about the recall. Signatures will be delivered today, and all indications are there will be a recall. And we do hope on Thursday, although we have yet to confirm, a guest from the Republican Party of Wisconsin. We hope that someone will be forthcoming soon. We will be talking Thursday at 9 about the Republican plans for the recall and vision for the state. So it's a busy week in politics. 800-486-8655 is our number. John Stanton, staff writer for Roll Call, is our guest. And we go next to Steve in Madison. Hi, Steve.
Yeah, good morning. As the snow falls here.
Yeah, same here. Is it heavy?
Yes.
Yeah.
We got maybe 2 or 3 inches.
And
I'm calling just with a rhetorical question. We heard the term democracy mentioned many, many times in this hour. At the same time, the speaker knows better than we do that the corporate influences has taken over all branches of government. So I'm wondering why he doesn't, and when the informed talking heads from Washington do not begin to use the word corporatocracy, which would accurately describe government, instead of using a quaint but totally dysfunctional term, democracy. When are we going to hear people who know start referring to the government as a corporatocracy on a regular, informed basis?
John?
Well, you know, I think those kind of decisions are definitely way above my pay grade in terms of changing the language of the culture. I do think that the color makes a very good point, that the corporations do have an undue influence on everything that goes on in this town. It's why we, there's, for instance, right now a big debate going on over, internet law, and there are sort of two sides that are fighting with each other. Both have their own sort of grassroots groups that are backing them. It's a bill called SOPA, which, some folks believe will strangle freedom on the internet, and others think it's a reasonable way to go about sort of helping expand the internet and pay for the costs and all that kind of thing. But really what you have is you have two groups of corporations that are sort of fighting with each other and using sort of the language of free speech and free access and that kind of thing for their own individual sort of gains. So, the caller is right that there is no escape from the fact that the corporate culture of politics and of Washington has sort of dominates now over the individual voter.
And we haven't seen anything yet. Wait until this election year gets in full swing. It's going to be incredible what we're going to see on television.
Oh, yeah. The Obama reelect alone is expecting to raise and spend $1 billion.
Wow.
This year. That is an astronomical amount of money.
I know.
And especially if you live in a swing state or, in Wisconsin, where you're going to have, the state-level politics is going to be very, very big, and the entire state is very much engaged in politics now, much more than maybe in the past, you're going to see a ton of money being spent just by his campaign, let alone, the unions and anti-union organizations,
right,
and Move On, and the anti-Move On organizations on the right, and all of these people are going to have millions of dollars to also spend. It's going to be extraordinary.
I know. We've already seen a ton of ads, and there's not even a recall yet.
Right, exactly. And then wait until the recall is finally on, and wait until, sort of primary and general election politics really start to pick up in a couple of months. It's going to be all anyone hears.
Yeah. So, right. So, Steve, thanks for the call. Joe in Franklin, hi.
Hi, Kathleen. Delight to talk to you again. I've got a question. Now, last year we had that joint committee that was going to come up with, I think it was $1.3 trillion of spending cuts, and if they couldn't agree, the cuts were going to go through automatically. I think it was half for defense, half for domestic spending. Of course, they couldn't agree. Are those cuts going to actually go through?
That's a good question. I think a lot of this depends on potentially on how the election plays out in November. None of the cuts and none of the hard things in the so-called trigger in the debt deal will go into effect until after the election next year. And so the Republicans don't want to see the cuts to defense spending at all. They're very concerned about it. They feel that it's far too much that should be coming from defense and that more should be coming from the domestic side. The Democrats argue, that's inappropriate, that we already have a deal, frankly, and that, you should not be able to change it. Although there are some Democrats that side with Republicans. The reality is that cutting more from the domestic side could be a little challenging because they've done so much already in terms of cuts to the domestic side. But if they extend it over 10 years, it could be easier. But I think this, like the fate of the Bush tax cuts, will all depend on what happens with the election. If Democrats do well, let's say they take back the House and Obama's reelected, and they either keep a majority in the Senate or they're just one vote shy in the Senate, let's say, of a majority, I think you'll see some change to that stuff. But if Republicans sweep the table particularly, they're going to be in no mood, I think, to extend Bush tax cuts. They're going to be in no mood to agree to changing anything on the triggers, and they're going to basically leave it to the Republicans to figure it out and do on their own in 2013.
Oh, okay. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Joe. We go next to Jim in Wanakee. Hi, Jim.
Hi. I wanted to ask the speaker about the effect of Citizens versus United. A lady called in earlier about how the congressional process is corrupted by, you know, the big interest groups and corporations, and we need campaign finance reform, and I agree with that. But I know that Senator Bernie Sanders from Vermont has introduced a bill to hopefully try to amend the Constitution and get this thing about corporations are people and money is free speech out of the equation there. And I'm wondering what the speaker thinks about that, if that would help clear up a lot of this gridlock and so forth. Because it seems to me like we're in a horrible situation where, you know, a lot of these people, they're working for the special interest groups rather than for the needs of the American, you know, forwarding the needs of the American people. And I just wonder what his comment is on that.
All right, thank you.
I think that it would, in the short term, it would help. But, you know, before Citizens United, there were laws that were controlling a lot of this in place, and corporations had already found ways around those. They were giving money to donations to, you know, foundations that members have. They were finding ways around it. And I don't know that it has become necessarily, in terms of how legislation happens, any better or worse since Citizen United. I think on the political side, clearly it's getting worse. And the problem, though, that I think Bernie Sanders faces, and that a lot of, you know, people that want to overturn Citizens United through legislation are facing, is that Democrats are quickly finding that super PACs and things like that are beneficial to them as well. And, you know, the unions are finding that they can use them. And while they don't have as much money and they don't have as big of super PACs yet as Republicans, they've already started to run with the idea as well. And if that becomes entrenched, I think it's going to become increasingly difficult to undo them and unring that bell.
Thank you, Jim. Don in West Salem. Hi.
Yes, good morning.
Hi, Don.
How are you today?
Fine, Don. How are you?
Oh, moving forward.
Well, good.
I have a couple questions. One is, when did it become law or whatever that Congress and politicians could vote themselves their own raises? And two, these people, politicians, are basically part-time people. They're elected for 6 years. And then they have to be reelected. Why is it that they're getting a full-time benefits and they're getting exorbitant wages? I've worked places where if I was a part-time person, I didn't get full-time medical care or health care. I didn't get exorbitant amount of money as a wage. Why? Aren't there step systems for first year, second year, third year, fourth year, whatever, as far as your salary? If you get a new candidate in there that hasn't worked before as a congressman, he has to learn how to do that job. Why does he get the same kind of wage that the politicians that have been there for 20 years get?
John.
Well, you know, it's actually funny. You know, on the first point, Congress, the Constitution requires Congress to sort of control the purse strings. So that is why Congress gets to set its own benefits packages and its own pay, and that's always been that way. You know, on the broader question, it's funny that, you know, I think some of the longer term members of the House and Senate would probably agree with the caller that maybe some of the new guys should not get paid quite as much as they do. You know, but it also is part of this broader sort of debate that has gone on in this country for a long time about, you know, whether or not politicians should be full-time or part-time, whether or not they should spend more time at home or more time in Washington. And there are, you know, there are a number of schools of thought. There are those that believe that the 1960s and 70s, 50s, 60s and 70s, when we saw a lot of major legislating going on, whether it was highways or the Civil Rights Act or, you know, war funding or whatever, That was done during a period in which members of the House and Senate spent the bulk of their time in Washington. They spent weekends here, they spent nights here without fundraising, and they got to know each other on a personal level and on a social level that helped create a climate in which they could find bipartisan agreement on things. There is the other school of thought that says that the longer that people, that these guys stay here around each other and around the lobbyists that are in Washington, the more corrupt they become and the more entrenched in their positions they become, and that we need to be constantly rotating fresh blood in. So I'm not quite sure which one is right. I think they both probably have their pluses and benefits. But
yeah. And a huge number of them don't need the money anyhow, right? I mean,
well,
a huge number.
Yes, is that you know, all of these people were already, you know, almost all of them were already millionaires before they even
right.
got here. To a certain degree, it's impossible for your average, you know, American to run. They will go to great pains to convince you that they are in fact an average American, but you know, don't be fooled. They make far more money than most of us do. So.
Yeah, John, thank you so much. It was really an interesting hour. Great calls today, I thought.
I totally agree.
Yeah, very, very good. Thank you. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.
Thanks. John Stanton, staff writer for Roll Call, joining us this hour to talk about the return of Congress from their winter break and what they're likely to accomplish in the new year, and it's not very much. Just a reminder, tomorrow at 9, Mike Tate, chair of the Wisconsin Democratic Party, is on for the hour to talk about the recall. And we hope to have someone from the Republican Party in the state of Wisconsin on Thursday to talk about the recall, all of those at 9 o'clock. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the hour, to Chrissy Pease for on-air production. Actually, thanks to Chrissy for producing the show and for on-air production as well. And we're going to talk about water, our number 2.